Today is Wednesday, the 26th of July, 2023. My name is Nigel Lynch, and I'm very pleased to be hosting this interview online via Teams with Dr. George Williamson. And we're here to discuss the IET Archives Oral History Project. So, George, could you please just start by telling us your full name and your association with the IET at the present time?
Well, I'm George Ian Williamson, and my current association with the IET is that I'm a member of the Anglian Coastal Network community. So for the last few years, I have been helping organise a series of events for our members and others who will be interested in the local area.
Okay, well, thank you very much. So we're going to start, as they say, at the beginning. Could you tell us a little bit about your childhood and education and what inspired you to get into engineering?
Right. Well, I was born in Edinburgh in 1955. My father was a joiner. And my mother had been, before she brought up the kids, a comptometer operator. So effectively, in those days, pre-computers, she was a computer. Comptometer operators ran the accounts for all manner of companies in those days. My father felt that it would be a good thing for me to get into engineering. He knew that I was a kind of academic lad, but he felt that it would be a good thing to get into electronics. He'd built radio control model boats himself, including etching the printed circuit boards and various things like that based on designs from practical electronics. And he thought this was a new thing which would give me a secure employment going forward. Of course, as a young lad, I had my own ideas, and I was mindful of what the teachers at school said. And they were nudging me towards a sort of academic route. So I signed up for mathematical physics in Edinburgh University, decided after a period that perhaps physics, rather than with the practical experimentation part, was more me, and did a degree in physics before then moving to Manchester to do a PhD in a physics subject. But I was still mindful of the fact that I was interested in getting things done. I knew that engineering was a way to do that. So when I finished the work for the PhD in 1980, I joined what was just called British Telecommunications, and it had been Post Office Telecommunications, to work on the development of a new generation of digital switches called System X.
So really going from theoretical physics into telephony, as it were, and switching, that's quite a jump, isn't it? Because they are different worlds. So how did you find that transition, you know, going from a theoretical physics to a practical engineering company?
Well, in a sense, I'd been moving in that direction for a while. So I was familiar with what my father had been doing with electronics and things of this nature. And then when I moved into the physics line, there were experiments and experimental setups, apparatus that you had to create as part of that that degree course. There were things that you needed to do in the computing sphere as well, software. So inevitably, I would do that. And when I moved to Manchester to do work in plasma physics, I was faced with quite a complex physical setup that was a magnetic confinement device, a vacuum device, into which plasma was injected, and into which we needed to insert various diagnostic probes. We needed to do analysis of the data that we were taking out of that system, a lot of computing there, Fortran programming. We needed to do analysis of the theory a lot of numerical analysis type things that were done to solve fairly complex integral differential equations. Now, that's a big word, but that's what they were. Essentially, you had to integrate the characteristics that the plasma, the energetic, the ionized particles would find in the magnetic field around the magnetic flux surfaces. And that's quite a complicated thing to do in a complex magnetic field topology. So we did that stuff. And I came out of that with a sense of what a system might feel like, but also the ability to drill down into detail and understand what's happening at the plasma physics level as well. The study was of turbulence in magnetically confined plasmas. The end goal was controlled fusion, right, and energy generation for fusion. So it was also associated with Cullum Laboratories, which is quite topical now. But the joke running was always that nuclear fusion was 30 years away and always would be. And it's quite interesting now that I heard Ian Chapman, who's the head of the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority, on the radio yesterday, and he was saying that they're expecting to connect a spherical tokamak to the grid in about 20 years' time.
So it's come down by 10 years, George.
It's come down by 10 years. So plainly, I would have made no difference to that schedule if I'd managed to stick with it. But I felt that I wanted to see some shorter term deliveries, even though I was working with some amazing people. My supervisor, Mike Rusbridge in Manchester, was a really top guy, very, very helpful. Had worked on Zeta, which was one of the early plasma physics experiments at Harwell in the 50s and 60s, I think. And he was a great help to me and really guided me through some very interesting work. I mean, I was very enthusiastic about it, but disappointed that it wasn't going to come to fruition in any short time when I was working on it.
So did you feel that moving into telecommunications would allow you to see the reality of your endeavors more quickly? Was that the motivation, do you think?
That was one of the motivations.
Right.
I was also mindful of the sometimes threadbare nature of the clothes that I was wearing as I was getting further and further into this PhD. And as you know, you're probably familiar with that in academia, as the tenuous and relationship that you have with security as a short term fellow or whatever it is that you might have in academia in those days.
Okay, well, so George, you join British Telecom and you go with a large breadth of skills, as you've just described, your computing skills, experimental skills, all that theoretical knowledge. Which part of British Telecom did you join? You mentioned starting to work on System X, but which division, which part of the country did you move to?
Well, I moved to London, much to the chagrin of my wife, who said, "I'll go anywhere with you." She wasn't my wife at the time. She said, "I'll go anywhere with you except London." So we went to London, and they had a headquarters building for the System X development department in a building which had been the headquarters of British Steel at the north end of Gower Street near Euston Station. And so that was where I was based. And I was working initially on something called Small Local Exchange Digital Subscriber Switching Subsystem, which was really the customer switch, where the customer ports were located. And it was really a concentrator put into the role of a small local exchange, and it was intended to be deployed in rural areas. After about a couple of years, we managed to make the first calls on that at Plessy and Beeston. I was working very closely with them, and that was a real positive milestone. However, we began to realize that the cost economics of that switch were never going to get to the point where you could deploy them cost effectively in very small rural locations. I mean, some of these were, you know, less than 500 lines, and the System X architecture really didn't scale down in terms of the cost for processing and so on and so forth to the extent that it needed to be. In the end, they chose scaled up PBXs. You've come across UXD5, Nigel, as the right solution for rural areas. They also wanted to move the contract for System X development from a time and materials basis into a prime contractor model with Plessy as the prime contractor. And the team I had been working with at Plessy Beeston took on the role as the integrating prime contractor for the large local exchange. So all the way through 1982 to about 1985, we worked really hard to pull everything together, to debug the large local exchange through many, many iterations in lab models in Beeston and Nottingham at Plessy, at Martlesham in the what was called the subsystem test facility, and ultimately at Baynard House, a live exchange location in the City of London. I have to say it was a very, very intense educational experience for me, and I was supported very much with some great great support and mentoring from a lot of real quality people in the organisation, both in BT and in Plessy.
It must have been an exciting time, because this was a major project. You were effectively embarking on a wholesale redesign of the UK telephone network into a fully electronic digital system, and perhaps a testament to the work that was done at that time that it's still working today. I mean, so that's still the system that is powering telephones, even though the switch over is coming. It has lasted throughout your career, really, hasn't it? There you were, starting with System X design. You take it through to the end of your career when you retired, and it was still there. It was still working. So that must be quite something to look back on.
It is. It's remarkable, really. We always felt it was somewhat over-engineered. I mean, there was a lot of care went into the engineering. I mean, for example, it was designed to be air-cooled in the main. The processor did have fans in it in the end, but it was designed to be air-cooled. And if you can make sure that it can be air-cooled, then you're running at a lower temperature and you've got a better chance of the components being able to last for a reasonable length of time. I think the engineering lifespan was probably about 20 years, but given that these were deployed from about the mid-80s and they'll run through to the mid-2020s, that means 40 years life, double
what you designed it for, yes.
Originally expected.
So where in this career do you first become aware of what at that time was the IEE? When do you become conscious of the professional body?
Well, within the groups in System X development department, there was quite a strong culture of people being members of the IEE. And I think that was also the case within Plessy and GEC and the other consortium teams. And I do know that I benefited from, you know, some good mentorship from managers in BT. Pete Maynard was one of them, who is a member of the IEE. And Jeff Wheat at Plessy, and I'm pretty sure he was a member of the IEE as well. But there was a positive culture about that. There was actually another organisation which was originally called the Institute of Post Office Electrical Engineers, which then became the Institute of BT Electrical Engineers, and I think is now the Institute of Telecoms Professionals. And you could join that quite easily by having some monies deducted straight away from your salary. And so I did, and there were certain specific journals which came out of that, which were quite helpful. But it was always felt that for proper recognition as a professional engineer, for the proper support and standards, and for the whole range of issues around code of ethics and so on, chartered engineering, that you had to join the IEE. Now, of course, as someone trained as a physicist, I felt I needed to spend a little bit time doing proper engineering before I felt that I was properly qualified to make a submission. And of course, that's what you would normally do anyway. Even if you do an engineering degree, you have to spend time with professional development before you can aspire to membership.
But did you join at that time? You could join as an associate member of the IEE leading towards chartered engineer. So did you do that, or did you first enter by going for chartership?
I delayed a bit further. I had been an associate member of the Institute of Physics, which won't surprise you.
I had been
there for a while. That made sense in terms of what I was doing. And there was a bit of residual time from leaving Manchester and completing my PhD, which I felt I had to do first. And I do recall that when I finally got round to that, the membership forms were quite bureaucratic, and I had to put a fair amount of effort into getting these right and getting these signed off by proposers and supporters. I went through a couple of more career stages before I finally got round to joining the IEE as a member. It took me to 1993. I did check.
Okay, that was my question. What year are we talking about? So
yeah.
You joined BT in the early 80s,
yeah.
And then you effectively go to the IEE for chartered membership in 93.
Yeah.
So what was it about? So you've already said about professional recognition, but why was that chartered engineer so important? You were clearly progressing through the ranks at BT. What was the added value in your mind for going into the chartered status?
Well, I had an interesting when I left System X development, I went to work on an EU project, one of the predecessors of Horizon called Esprit.
Yes.
And we were looking at the development of knowledge-based systems and various forms of advanced information processing technology to the maintenance of engineering systems. So in the case that we were interested in, it was telecommunication switches, but there was also another couple of members in the consortium who were interested in applying that to the management of nuclear power plants. So it was a small consortium. So ourselves, I ended up with a team of about four people working on it, but working with Queen Mary and Westfield College, with a group headed by a chap by the name of Abe Mamdani, who had been the inventor of fuzzy control and had applied fuzzy control techniques to the management of cement kilns. So he had an interest in doing practical things with the technology. And there was a French company, which is a subsidiary of the French atomic energy organization Framatome, and a German company called Krupp. And we did some very, very interesting work at that time, breaking new ground and working with some very, very powerful computing and software environments. Now, while I was working on that, I felt that I had quite a lot of breadth in my network and contacts, which was helpful for my career. So I didn't really look head down on that. Although Abe Mamdani was a fellow of the IEE, and actually also a fellow of the IEEE, and he was quite positive about the benefits of joining these professional organizations. But it took another step change in my career before I finally got round to doing that in 1983. So
And what was that step change that made you do it?
Well, I then moved on to work on something called RACE, which was another EU program. It was it built on some of the stuff we'd done with the KBS project, which was an Esprit called Critic. And the RACE one was really all about advanced broadband communications. And I led an activity on the architecture for management of that, which was telecommunications management network. And that led us into a whole raft of activities around advanced information processing, distributed computing, distributed databases, all the right kind of communication protocols to manage distributed telecommunications networks and broadband services over these. And a lot of these were precursors to many of the activities you see in standardization organizations and pre-standardization organizations like Telemanagement Forum. So these things were all there, and there was a big network. But when I came to the end of that, and I then focused more internally on BT, I felt that joining the IEE would be a very positive thing to build out my network of contacts into wider industry, or more properly, retain my network of wider contacts into the industry and keep abreast of things that are going on outside an organization, which left to its own deserts would be very internally focused.
And how did you maintain that network? Was that by going to events that the IEE was organizing? Were you actively engaged in that respect?
Well, around that time in 1993 was probably, I joined the IEE, so I had good proposers and supporters, which meant that the barring the bureaucracy of filling in the forms, it was fairly straightforward for me to become a member of the IEE and a chartered engineer. Fairly shortly thereafter, or around that time, I joined one of the professional groups, and it was one you and I worked on together. And we were trying to remember whether it was E7 or C3, but in the first period, it was either of these. And the focus of it was distributed computing and networks. And of course, in those days, it was pre the World Wide Web and all the massive take-up of the internet. I mean, internet protocol was around, but it was before all of these things had become commonplace.
Yes, yes. So obviously you joined, you became an active committee member effectively at national level at Savoy Place with the professional groups.
Yes, indeed.
And did you also get involved in the local network at that stage, or was it just the national level at that point?
It was mainly the national level, and it was because I'd taken up a role as a section manager and a program manager with responsibility for the open platform for a lot of BT's operational support systems. The part of the value for me was maintaining a set of contacts which would give a broader view of what the industry was doing around distributed computing. So this was around a time when Unix systems were becoming more mainstream, where open communications protocols were developing, where databases were becoming distributed, where we were moving towards object databases and things of this nature. Where graphical user interfaces on workstations and then PCs were becoming the norm. All of these things used properly would allow operational organizations to integrate their IT support for their business. You know, I was working in BT's network management department, and the first thing that network management department did was they developed something called Operations and Maintenance Center, which was the management system to manage the remotely and centrally the system X switches that we put all the effort into developing. So we built specific interfaces over X25 protocols, if you remember these, which used the man-machine interfaces over X25 as a means of interacting with the switch to set up its configuration from a central point, to pick up alarms and and deal with them at a central point in the network, and to deal with all the other housekeeping things that you would expect to have, to deal with billing and all the rest of that.
Yeah, so that it was nice that you kind of brought your System X experience in at that point, isn't it? You're kind of almost closing the loop in your career.
We used telecom switches in the Esprit project and in the Race project background to as background to the kinds of things that that we were looking to develop.
Obviously a key thing there, you talked about the IEE helping you with your network, and you're talking there about keeping you, as it were, abreast of other developments by interacting with people at professional group level. Did it in any way, having a membership and volunteering, you know, you are giving up your time to contribute to the professional group. How do you feel that played back into your own career development within British Telecom?
Well, I think that I felt it was important to organise a number of events which were relevant to the area of work that I was involved in, shed light on that, and helped me to develop a broader understanding of how everything that we were doing was fitting into the industry direction, whatever that was at the time.
So is there a particular event that you sort of pull out as a highlight in all of this?
There are a whole series of events. We ran events on distributed computing architectures. We ran events on telecommunications management network and signaling. We ran events on distributed databases. And we ran with Doug Shepherd, if you recall, who was the chair of that group at the time, the first event about World Wide Web and Internet. That the IET held, and this was at Savoy Place. I can't recall exactly when that would be, but I seem to recall it was a very well attended event, and we had some pretty well known keynote speakers involved in it.
And what do you get out? You know, I'm just thinking again, you know, you're devoting your time and energy to organizing these events. What do you get in return? Why do you do it? What is it that it's doing for you? What are you getting back from this activity?
Well, when you get involved in these things, you always learn from the people that that you engage with it. You always learn about how they present their arguments. You always learn more about the context to which these technologies are being applied. You learn more of the way in which you might be able to present these things to non-technical audiences. There's a different range of skills from just engineering that you have to bring to bear. I mean, one of the positive things that I've supported the IET in recently is Present Around the World.
And Present Around the World. Tell us a little bit about that. What does that involve?
Well, this is a community activity recently, but Present Around the World, it was a competition. It's currently in abeyance, but it's a competition that we took to younger members and potential members of the IET, and give them the opportunity to present a technical subject in a 10-minute period and deal with some questions. Because being able to present in a lucid way to people who are not specialists in that subject is an important skill, I believe, for any engineer to have. So some of these kinds of attributes you would inevitably develop by participating in these events. It's a very important skill, being able to stand up and communicate to an audience which isn't specialized in your domain and make sure that you're able to tell them something relevant.
Yeah, no, absolutely. As you say, a very important, one of the softer skills of engineering, as it were. I just want to fast forward us a little bit, George, in terms of your career and your relationship with the IEE, now becoming IET. You've obviously progressed through the company, British Telecom, take on more senior roles. Did you develop your membership with the IEE? Did you take it from chartered membership to fellow, and then obviously as you then move into a retirement from full-time work, did you maintain your association with the institution in a different capacity perhaps?
Yes, I've had a look at my records, and I did look to move on to fellowship in 2005.
And what was the motivation for doing that? Why would you go for fellowship?
At that time in BT, BT had brought in a new CIO who was quite an aggressive change manager. And a lot of the people who were within the management structure in the technology part of the BT business at that point in time, their jobs were in question, shall we put it that way. I felt my job was in question, and I felt that moving my membership level of the IEEE at that point in time from member to fellow might be a helpful thing to do. As it turned out, once again, I'd built up quite a decent portfolio of track record in various things. I mean, for example, I'd done work on intelligent networking, where we'd had a major replatform for the BT's intelligent network platform. At one point, we were going to build something in common with MCI, but when BT and MCI chose not to merge, we had to pull back a development in line back into the UK and get that deployed before year 2000. So that went pretty smoothly for a development project which was in track in that way. And so we got a very strong team, sent them over to United States, to Colorado Springs, and to move the technology on from a very expert team in MCI led by a lady called Patrice Carroll. And that move was engineered pretty smoothly back into Ipswich. We integrated and we were able to run televotes about eight months before the year 2K deadline, which we would not have been able to do in 2001 without having done that. So it was pretty important to do that. If you recall, the intelligent networks at that time supported all of the non-geographical services for voice, the 0800s and all the rest of these things. And that was really the e-commerce platform before the internet.
Right.
Of course, it also had a role for the internet as well, because in those days before broadband, it also supported all of the access to the internet through the modems. If you remember the modem connections that we had to the internet in the early days before broadband became prevalent. So
yes,
we've done
yes,
that.
Indeed, I do.
So with some of that track record and that being recognized by people on the membership committees on the IET, then it was fairly straightforward for me to get my membership upgraded into fellowship level. It yes. also helped me because I felt that there was a risk that I might be on the jobs market at some point, and I would have to do something about that.
Yeah. But fortunately, you weren't. When you actually retired from your full-time position, what position did you hold within the BT group?
Well, I moved around 2006 at the start of Openreach. I was in a fortunate position to take on the job of Director of Strategic Network Design for Openreach, which meant that I was effectively the person who had to work out what Openreach's future network capabilities and some of the propositions that these would enable would be. And preeminent amongst these was the whole effort that we had to put in place to make the case for next generation access. So that was fibre to premise and fibre to cabinet.
Right.
So in many ways, it's a privilege. It felt like being in a startup organisation, but with a huge factory behind you to allow you to do things. And we were fortunate to be able to build up fibre to premise propositions in Ebbsfleet, and then a set of fibre to cabinet based propositions delivered in a consistent Ethernet form, which allowed Openreach at the time to do what it called its mixed economy model for delivery. So choosing the right technology based on the right cost and other economics in a particular locale. And that's what's enabling Openreach to push on now with fibre to premise with a big build to get to something like, I think it's 25 million by 2030. I'm bound to be wrong on this thing, so because I'm not involved.
But being there at the beginning, you could set the agenda, set the strategy.
We set the direction, and we gave the business options which it could then play depending on the economic factors which were in play at the time.
So what's your role, chief engineer of Openreach at that point?
No, I started off as effectively chief technology officer for the next generation access program, plus responsibility for all the copper and the point-to-point ethernets and the wireless related propositions and all that stuff as well. And then by the end, I was chief engineer as well. So the fellow who'd recruited me into Openreach retired, Bob Cowie, who was very, very helpful. And I took over as chief engineer for a bit more than a year, but not much more than a year.
Okay. So again, going back to the IET journey, when you left full-time employment with Openreach, you continued your involvement with the IET, but now you, by my understanding, is you became more involved locally.
That's right.
And what exactly do you now do for the Anglian Coastal Network?
Anglian Coastal Network is quite a large area. It's actually North Essex, Suffolk and Norfolk. So when I joined, we were organising events, so lectures and talks, visits to places for members and non-members in the area, and looking to drive interest, do things which are of interest to our members, do things which are relevant to our members, and find ways in which we could increase our reach. I had done a couple of presentations for them before I joined them on the committee, but a fellow that I'd worked with at BT in the labs, Mick Miller, persuaded me that I might find it interesting to get involved and organize some events for and with them. I did chair for a period, but now I'm an ordinary member again, and I find it very, very worthwhile.
Could you elaborate on that? What is it again? What makes it worthwhile? You retire from full time work. Some of the benefits you spoke about earlier, whilst you're going through your career, probably don't apply now. So what is it that keeps you motivated to work on the committee and organize events and give up your free time?
Well, I retain interest in all manner of issues, science and technological. I want to maintain at least a passing understanding in that. I pay more attention to the things that I've worked in the past. So I pay attention to plasma physics and nuclear fusion. I pay attention to all the stuff which is going on in AI. And I pay attention to the things that are happening in telecommunications. I found that helpful. When I left Openreach, I did consult for a while, and I consulted with various regulators. I consulted with a satellite consortium. I consulted with an operator are in the West Indies on network strategy. So I did a few things, and certainly some of the things that I did with the Anglian Coastal Network were helpful in that regard. So, for example, we were able to work with former colleagues in BT's labs in Adastral Park, and they would always give us a few talks. We were able to engage with other players in the telecommunications industry for talks. You've given talks yourself, Nigel.
Yes, I have. You have persuaded me, George.
I have persuaded you. And indeed, I have given talks for your...
Right. It is a quid pro quo.
Yes. So quid pro quo, you scratch my back, all that kind of stuff.
But so, that comes back really to your earlier comment about the networking, doesn't it? Who you know and the network of people that you get to know through the professional body. You know, you and I met, as you said, on the professional group, and we may never have met in any other forum, potentially.
That's exactly right. And it's been a very valuable relationship for me, that's for sure, to work with you over the years. And I'm very pleased to be helping you of that, George.
Can we try and summarise or... the relationship between you and what is now the IET, you joined it when it was like I did when it was the IEE. What could you actually summarize? What does the IET mean for you? You've obviously been very actively involved at various levels. So
it's a professional home. It's an organization which can bring together people who are interested in moving the world forward in a positive way. I think that the IET's standards code of ethics is a positive, no doubt about it. It's helped me at times when I've been under pressure in business and say, for example, a marketing person might say, I'd like to say this. I said, well, you might say that, I couldn't possibly, or whatever.
Yes.
Common phrase, you know. So as an engineer, I'm honour bound to not to misrepresent things where I know that that they are true. So it's been a support in that regard. It's been a support in that it's helps lots of people to keep abreast. Yes. I mean, one thing I would like to draw your attention to is that in the lockdown period in COVID, we realised that we would not have a programme if we weren't able to do something on the internet and through webinar. So we pretty quickly switched our events onto a webinar basis. And we did a bit more than that, actually. I engaged my former colleagues at BT. And you remember Doug Williams and Ian Cagle, sadly passed.
Yes.
Doug Williams had done a nice talk for you at the FTSE Congress.
Yes.
And with Ian Cagle. And I persuaded Doug and Ian to take us on a virtual visit of BT Labs to see what the future of TV might hold.
Right.
So they integrated all manner of media. And I knew this would be quite a complicated thing to get right. They integrated all manner of media and were able to present that in a coherent story about the future of TV, including all the contexted information that you might provide, say, for example, when you're watching a football match or whatever. And of course, from the FTSE Congress and the things that you do with your media colleagues in University of Salford, you know all this kind of stuff. And I do recall at one point in the early 90s, after I'd finished with Race, I helped out a project that was running out of Race, which was using integrated broadband communications to deliver a summer school in multiple locations. And there were three prime sites: Madrid, Aveiro in Portugal, and Naples in Italy, and then about 12 other sites in other telecoms labs around Europe. And we delivered a summer school over that medium when the technology was quite quite nascent, primitive. Quite primitive. We did have a Spanish, it was University of Politécnica de Madrid, computers supported cooperative working software. There was a chap there, Juan Camada. He had some software which we were using to integrate all the media streams and all the QA things that you might seek to do from multiple locations. But that gave us some great insight as to what it really took to run complex web-based deliveries. Yeah,
and as you say,
before the internet was prevalent.
Well, yeah. Absolutely, it was, yes, and pioneering, in fact, George.
Absolutely.
But what effectively there you were able to do with the Coastal Network is keep the members informed and keep a sense of community going, even when we were all in lockdown of one form or another. So what would your advice
more,
be?
More than that, we were able to broaden our audience base.
Yes, of course.
So on some events, we had registrations in the several hundreds, you know, more than 500, which was the limit on the system. I seem to recall Andy Sutton, our colleague at BT, attracted more than 700 registrations for a talk about 5G.
And of course, it's a global audience, isn't it? When you're online,
audience.
Yes.
We recently have hosted speakers from west coast of the United States. So there's one well-known blogger on AI gave us a fantastic survey of AI just after ChatGPT had been launched, totally up to date, and he did that from British Columbia.
Brilliant.
So with his extensive contacts directly into the AI community over there, he was able to bring us insights that were pretty uncommon. And once again, we get a pretty big audience for that. So we attract speakers and audiences which are difficult for to bring over to Ipswich or Norwich or wherever it is we might want to want to host something.
That's absolutely excellent, George. Now, just really as we sum up and get to the end of the interview, I'm very interested just for you perhaps to reflect on your own career and particularly your relationship with the institution, IEE, then IET. What could you, if you were talking to someone, the recently graduated George Williamson from all those years ago, based on your experience of being in the IEE, IET, being very active, how would you sell it to them? What would you say would be the benefits of being an active member of the professional body or even just being a member?
I would be skeptical that there would be too many benefits if you weren't active in the organization.
Okay.
I think you need to contribute to benefit to some extent. So if you are an active participant in one of the communities, that naturally brings you to networking opportunities.
Yes.
It brings you to opportunities where you might find people who might mentor you, because that's a very important thing to find, particularly in the early parts of your career. If you're active in organizing events, then you can organize events that you think will be relevant to you. Although you have to be mindful, it can't be very specific to your project. It has to be of wider interest as well. But if you do it in the right way, there's a definite win-win for yourself and for the wider community. And of course, when you do that, you naturally find ways in which you can engage with the community in a more proactive way. And it is genuinely quite helpful.
And I think you've evidenced that throughout this interview of life experience, where the IET has helped you and you've made a major contribution to the professional body as well. George, on behalf of the IET, I'd like to thank you for your time talking to me and reflecting on both your career and also your relationship with the IET. So thank you very much indeed. And thank you for taking time for this interview. Thank you.
It's a pleasure, Nigel, as always.